Our time with the Holy Scriptures together, we're going to look at page 249 in the Church Bibles. Page 249, we're looking at Judges chapter 7. We're thinking about flawed heroes as we continue in our studies of the judges and these different individuals who God raised up. Today we're thinking about an impossible feat. We've heard the reading already taken by our young people. Now as we look at chapter 7 of Judges, let me just begin with verse 2. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands." We're talking about resources. There was a time many years ago in the history of the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, it was then called the China Inland Mission, when one of its home directors, an intrepid missionary, he'd been one all of his life, was in England on his way to speak at a missionary gathering. And he didn't realize that they'd put the bus fare up by a penny that week. So as he got to the bus stop, he realized this. And he only brought just enough for the fare, as he had thought it was. Then he realized he was a penny short. He was in desperation. He had to speak. So he thought, "I don't know what to do. What am I going to do?" Then he thought, "This is ridiculous. Here am I, leader in a world missionary endeavor. I've been used to praying in money all my life. Why cannot I trust God for a penny?" So he leant against the bus stop shelter, shut his eyes, and asked for a penny. Just then, a friend came by, tapped him on the shoulder, and in the old English idiomatic expression, seeing his eyes shut, said, "A penny for your thoughts." The man whirled round, said, "Give me that penny and I'll tell you my thoughts." The man handed it over and he said, "I was praying for that penny." When something like that happens to us Christians, we tend to gasp. Why, we say, "God actually heard my prayer. He was listening. How can he be interested in such an ordinary person? We can't believe it." So it was with the Old Testament character of Gideon, whose call to God's service we were studying in our last sermon. He was the least in a very insignificant family in the Old Testament. And when the call of God came to him, he couldn't believe it. He had to have a sign, and last week we were reading of how at just a touch from God, the meal that Gideon had prepared for his divine visitor was consumed by fire. Then it was the fleece, because Gideon couldn't believe. Judges chapter 6, verse 36, in our last week's study, took us to that moment when Gideon's faith failed him, and he said, "I'm putting out the fleece." Well, quite frankly, as we were reminded last week, a person with a robust faith in God doesn't need special signs from heaven, whether it's a matter of praying for a penny or praying about a fleece. It's no sign, honestly, of spiritual maturity when a believer exclaims, "I'm putting out the fleece. Give me a special sign. Then I'll follow you. Then I'll obey you." All of this in Judges points to the fact that Gideon was indeed a very ordinary person of ordinary, limited faith. The world is full of people like Gideon. As we look at ourselves and look too at our family of the church, we can't believe that God has actually taken on such a feeble-looking show. Gideon, in the New Testament book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, is included in the company described as such a great cloud of witnesses. And that's us. It's us too. We hardly seem to measure up to the identification. There used to be a joke that was once circulated about one of the departments in Moscow's Kremlin. Outside one imposing-looking entrance was the inscription, "Commissar for the electrification of all the Russias." Then underneath, by the bell push, was a little notice. Bell out of order. Please knock. Well, I suppose that's how the world tends to think sometimes of the church. The group for the evangelization of all the world. We don't always feel that we're measuring up. We allow ourselves sometimes to be conned by the propaganda coming at us from all sides. And rarely does God's style of performance stun us with brilliance. It isn't his style. He doesn't overwhelm us with incandescent power. This is indeed a story of victory here in Judges 7. Overwhelming victory. But it's the story of Gideon and the overwhelming minority. Gideon, the farmer who became a general. This is what we're thinking about. He's become the leader of Israel's forces. Chapter 7, verse 1. He's scraping together every recruit he can possibly get because the Bedouin hordes, armed with their new centurion camels, outnumber the Israelites by about 4 to 1. But does God take any great account of statistics? Lesson number one in our study, I call, a lesson in strength. Chapter 7. Look at verse 2 and 3, would you? Keep your eyes down, look at the verse, then look at me, look at the Bible. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. If you and I had been the advisors to Gideon, what would we have said to him that day? I think we would have drawn attention to the opposing Midianite threat. We'd have said, "Now look at them over there on the opposite hill, Gideon. There's an awful lot of them. General, can you see the size of the force that you're up against?" Poor Gideon, he'd been trying not to see them. A crash program of recruitment seemed the only answer, but not in God's opinion. If anything, the army needed to be slimmed down. I don't suppose Gideon reduced his numbers, as he was commanded to do, with any great enthusiasm. "Now, men," he'd have said, I very much hope you're all going to stay enlisted. We have a great adventure in front of us, men. It's a great life in the Gideons. God's on our side, men. But if anyone feels they can't quite rise to coming on this campaign, you don't actually want to do much fighting, well, you can return home, men. But of course, I hope you'll all do the decent thing and stay on, and whoomp. Before you could blink, the army was down to a third of its size. Like quicksilver, 22,000 men vanished in a cloud of dust over the horizon. Had everyone gone? Ah, no, 10,000 were left. They'd passed the courage test. Now came the caution test, the readiness test. Because God seemed to be saying, "Gideon, your arm is still too big, it's like an overgrown cabbage. Weed it out further still. And when you take those 10,000 men down to the river for a drink, I'll tell you which ones to keep." And down to the river, verses 4 to 8, went the army. It was a lovely day. Ah, wonderful. But very, very hot. Everybody suddenly seems to be complaining of a raging thirst. And that's the test, Gideon. It all depends on the way they drink. You know that if you have no cup and you want a drink of water, there are two ways of doing it. Either you make a cup out of your hand, bringing the water up to your mouth, or you get right down and dip your face into the water, getting everything else wet as well. One was, I suppose, the way of preparedness, your weapons in one hand as you drank upright of the other hand. The other way is the way of recklessness, lying flat on the bank, your face in the water, oblivious to everything else. But you mustn't tell them, Gideon, because that would spoil the whole plan. I remember I was told this story when I was about 6 or 7 years of age by my mother. That's what she coached me in saying and thinking. She said, it's the way of preparedness. They were ready. If you were ready, then you'd have your water coming up in your hand to your mouth, but you were keeping your eyes open with your weapons in your other hand, ready. Mustn't tell them, Gideon, that would spoil the whole thing. Right, men, bellows one of the officers. By the right drink. And oh dear, oh dear. It looks as though every single one of them is flat down on all fours, drinking the wrong way. Oh no, there isn't. There's one who's doing it the right way. He's been brought up properly by his mother. Take his name, Sergeant. Oh, and another one over there. Take his name. And there. And there's another. Take his name. How many? Tot them up, Sergeant. How many? 300. Very good. An interesting exercise in bringing an army up to its effective strength. This is the lesson of the few. It's been with us for many centuries. It's the lesson that strength is not numbered by numbers. The group, the fellowship, the church may have many recruits who seem enthusiastic. They're singing the old hymns with great cheerfulness, but too often they can be found singing the old gospel song, standing on the promises, when in reality they're sitting on the premises, as somebody once said. There's so much dead weight. People reveal themselves in little ways. And the story here, by the way they drink. There were many battles in the Old Testament, many. Not because God is the author of war or violence, but because we are a fallen rebel race. The age of the judges, back in the 12th and 11th centuries BC, was a particularly rude and rough age, and God had to use rude instruments in achieving his eternal purposes. This is the story of the general without an army, and it's a lesson about strength, because real strength isn't measured by numbers or by material resources. The evangelist John Wesley, of 200 years ago, who changed the face of Britain, once said, give me 100 people who love God with all their hearts and fear nothing but sin, and I will move the world. And he did. The greatest man of the 18th century. While the French were having their French Revolution across the Channel, we didn't. We were spared that. We had a Bible revolution instead, thanks to John and Charles Wesley, who said, by the grace of God, we are going to change history. Just a few. We'll never know the real strength of our company here, at this Church of All Souls. Only God will see and know who's actually involved. Praying, giving, planning, studying, dedicating, interceding, loving, helping. That's between us and him alone. When the crack of doom sounds and we get to heaven and we see who are the people who are actually carrying the whole thing, I think we shall find it was the quiet interceders. We shall probably find a bunch of senior citizens in the very front row. They were the ones who were carrying us. In this account, God alone knew who could be trusted when the going got rough and the battle began. This is a lesson in strength. Secondly, it's a lesson in style. Because as we read on, we come to yet a further reassurance that Gideon required. He was a very ordinary person. He found it difficult to believe that God was involved in the deliverance of Israel from the Midianite and Amalekite oppression. So comes the night exercise, verses 9 to 14. We had it read. The secret excursion of Gideon and one assistant to the camp of the enemy across the valley of Jezreel, one of the great battlefields of the world. It's nothing much that they come back with, just an account of a dream told by one Midianite sentry to another. Actually, I'd have thought that that might have warranted a court-martial. Sentries are supposed to be watching, not dreaming. And in his Middle East way, this alien sentry describes what he saw. Verse 13, he saw a barley loaf, a barley cake, tumbling down and hitting one of the Midianite tents, one of their own tents, flattening it in the process. I don't know that I've for sure that I've ever eaten barley bread. Have you? Maybe you have. It was the Jewish historian Josephus of old who said of barley bread that men can hardly eat it for its coarseness. Remember, the Israelites had been so reduced by the Midianite raids that this was the level that they were living at now. Barley bread, that's what they were eating. A despised cake of barley bread was evidently associated with the Israelites in the sentry's understanding. Hence the immediate interpretation by the other sentry, who identifies this cheap, nasty, round little biscuit with Gideon. It's not an awfully flattering logo, is it? In commenting on this passage, the great Baptist preacher C.H. Spurgeon once said, "If I had to cannonade an encampment, I would not bombard it with biscuits." But this, amazingly, is God's style. He uses the feeblest of instruments. We read in Isaiah 40, verse 29, "He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength." Is that you? Is that us? Because if so, it's good news. Sometimes the feeblest of instruments can halt the toughest of adversaries, sometimes incongruously so. Remember hearing when there was a coup in an African country and a line of supposedly invincible tanks came rumbling up the main street of the capital. And then amazingly and incongruously, they all dutifully stopped when they got to the traffic lights. Well, that happens, I suppose, in some parts of the world. Now, do you yourself as a believer, maybe a new believer, is there somebody who's just days old in the life of adventure and faith with Jesus Christ, a new believer here, and you feel yourself to be a bit weak, a bit vulnerable, a bit exposed? You think, "Oh, I'm never going to be able to make this thing of the Christian life. Already I feel the pressures building up against me. People don't understand. I feel lonely here in London. Is anyone going to help me?" Take this lesson in style to heart today. All of us feel as though God can never use us. But the world is full of people like Gideon. Think of Paul the Apostle on that rocking boat on the Adriatic Sea, feeling seasick and awful. Think of those 12 apostles. Among them were fishermen, rogues, and cheats. Just 10 good people would have been enough to save Sodom and Gomorrah from destruction in the Old Testament. Or someone here, and I don't know who you would be, I'm not telepathic, facing some impossible situation. You think, "I don't even know how to face the next week, let alone the rest of this year." And you feel as brittle as a barley biscuit. Recognize, if you're in a frail situation, a fragile situation with your own family, it isn't all sweetness and light, I know, on Mothering Sunday. Some families have great difficulties and tensions. But recognize that if you're a follower of Christ, you're the key person in the family. Here's a lesson in strength, and it's also a lesson in style. And thirdly, it's a lesson in, shall we call it, strategy? We move from the thought of the general without an army to that of the victory without a battle. It's thrilling. Verse 15 and 16. "When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, 'Get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands.' Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. 'Watch me,' he told them, Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. The hour approaches. Verse 16, the famous 300, they line up for their equipment. Can you see them in your imagination? Right, Sergeant, to each man issue one clay pot. Excuse me, General, did you say clay pots? Correct. One clay pot, one trumpet, and one torch. The torch bit I can understand because when I used to go to my Scripture Union camps in the summer, way back when I was a teenager, we were always told you bring a Bible with you and a torch. We never knew what the torch was to be for, but we had to bring a torch. Well, of course, these torches were different from ours. They were more like a firebrand, and they could hide them in the clay pots. The clay pots! What would the professionals have said? You can't fight a Midianite horde with clay pots. And how would you and I have coped? Anyway, a clay pot and a trumpet and a torch, three arms? Well, no, because the torch can go inside the clay pot when the moment comes to smash the clay pot. Well, we know what happened. We've heard the story. Something a bit like it happened centuries later at a place called Thermopylae in southeastern Greece, 480 BC, at a narrow pass about 14 yards wide between Mount Oeta and the sea, when Leonidas, the Spartan king, made his heroic defense against the advancing Persian army of Xerxes, and he only had a mere 300. But this was even more spectacular. Gideon wasn't just defending a pass. He was on the attack. And the strategy had all been worked out. There's tremendous confidence there in verse 17. Watch me. Follow my lead. Do as I do. At the right moment, you'll be standing around the Midianite camp. I'll give the signal. You smash the clay pots. The torches will come out. And then the sword of the Lord and for Gideon. You should bellow at the top of your voice. The preparation, the initiative, it's all taken. See, at the moment, the impression is being given worldwide that the church is on the defense, that we're crumbling. It's not true. The church is the fastest advancing family of faith in the world, in just numbers. It doesn't look like that, however. We feel very feeble. Here in Britain, the headlines are never for us, never. Even in the church press, the headlines aren't always for us. Do you realize that? There's a tremendous cynicism around. And sometimes it can get people down when they look at the headlines and think, poor us, aren't we awful? Think actively. Think victoriously. We're not defending, we're advancing. That's how to think. Gideon wasn't thinking defensively. He was thinking in terms of advance, attack. That is how we are meant to be thinking. I want to be a part of God's strategy. I want my very limited resources and money to be like that hard little barley biscuit, to be a tool for God. What is it that you can offer? Think about it. A barley biscuit? See, it's better than that. What are the resources? The weapons are so different, absolutely different. It isn't money. It isn't even great numbers of people. It isn't even putting on a super show, and we were thrilled to be part of it last night in the Royal Albert Hall. That's a wonderful gesture, and we believe that God will use it. But we're not dependent on that. When you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, the Apostle Paul says, "The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds." Verse 3, "Though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does." So these ought to be thought of as very stirring days in which to be living. Now, do you think that? Stirring days, challenging days. But don't let's say to ourselves, these are difficult days. I know that clergy like myself have been saying that for a long time. You read in vicars 80 years ago. Look at their parish magazines. 80 years ago, open up the vicar's letter. What does he say? These difficult days in which we live. They've always been saying that. Don't think that. Then as you look at the battle here, why, it's no battle at all. The blast of the trumpets, the smashing of the pots, the ringing watchword, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon, and the resulting chaos in the Bedouin camp. Men fighting against men, the camels running amok, the breathless flight back over the Jordan, and the intrepid 300 standing like little rocks, blowing their trumpets and shouting their watchword into the night sky. It was the end of a seven-year reign of tyranny. 300 with God, accomplishing in an evening what over 32,000 men could never have been trusted to do. It's a lesson in strength, in style, in strategy. Years ago in Britain, there was an advert. You'd see it sometimes on the underground, in the railway carriages. Vogue is read by the overwhelming minority of women. Very clever advert. But it's our slogan, the overwhelming minority. We say this in no mere triumphalistic style. It is biblical. Don't be dazzled, then, by the swarming statistics of today's society. Do not let us be dwarfed by the towering power structures of today. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us, kept by the power of God. They overcame by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. Reminder after glorious reminder, reverberating through the pages of this wonderful book. It's there we find our resources and the reassurance. With God, a rabble army, a sort of dad's army, proves to be the overwhelming minority. There's a plus factor if God is in the field, and it's prayer and the scriptures and fellowship together and helping each other along that ensures that God is in the picture. And so chapter 8, verse 4, finds Gideon and his men as conquerors, amazingly, graphically described in the Old King James Version as faint yet pursuing. Very ordinary people, and as brittle as a barley biscuit. And the world is full of people like Gideon. Let's pray. Keep us always, Lord, from triumphalism. Keep us from focusing upon the numbers game. Help us again and again to realize the dependence upon you in humble prayer, meeting together in fellowship, reliance upon the holy weapons of warfare is the right approach. Encourage us this day just by seeing each other, just by being together, and supremely by being at your feet. We ask these things for your name's sake. Amen.